And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when the Israeli military hit Iran early this morning. It was actually at night, based upon Middle Eastern time. They actually struck a military facility in central Iran. The reports that both Iranian and Israeli officials are trying to avoid escalation. We'll be speaking with Victor David Hansen, historian with the Hoover Institution at Stanford, who has written a very provocative piece about whether these recent developments, which we'll bring you up to date on entirely, represent the end of the road for the Islamic revolutionary regime that has been such a problem for the rest of the world in Iran. We will also be speaking to him about the lies that have been promulgated everywhere about the crisis in Gaza. We're going to be speaking on the other side of things here in the United States. What do you do to end the road closing protests that actually gobble up time and effort and they've led to arrests? Is there a more efficient way of clearing our roads so people can get to doctor's appointments or to business appointments or to see your parole officer, whatever it happens to be? We will be talking to columnist Megan McArdle, who has a great solution in mind. And speaking of a great solution in mind, Arthur Brooks is a great friend of the show. He is the guru of happiness, and he reacts not just to the happiness survey where the United States dropped out of the top 20. United States, not a happy country right now. Why not? And what are the things that you can do to provide greater happiness, particularly people who have children? Speaking of greater happiness, there was a horrific incident that occurred. It was less than an hour ago, I believe, or close to an hour ago, in front of the courthouse in Manhattan with President Trump inside the courthouse. They finished selecting their jury. We'll bring you up to date on that and what the jury looks like and some of the surprises in the jury composition. But somebody not yet identified, a male, threw some pamphlets into the air and then lit himself on fire. He apparently poured gasoline over his own head and then took out a lighter or a match, people are unsure, and lit himself all over his body. He is now in hospital. It is unclear whether he will survive or what his motivation was doing that kind of self-harm in front of the courthouse with everything else going on. Are going to be speaking about that and about the ongoing trial, which now has a jury. They're going to proceed, apparently, to opening statements coming up on Monday. Peggy Noonan, in her column tomorrow for the Wall Street Journal, talks about bad leadership, and not just among Joe Biden, not just among Donald Trump, not just here in the United States, but throughout the Western world, particularly in Britain, and suggests that bad leadership is a national security threat. There's a report in the Jerusalem Post that says that Israel targeted the defense system of the Natanz nuclear facility in Iran during its strikes this morning. That is the judgment of a senior American official who was quoted by ABC. The Israelis were targeting an air defense radar site near Isfahan that's part of the protection of the Natanz nuclear facility, ABC said. The first assessment is that the strike took out the site, but assessment hasn't been completed, the official said. And this from the New York Times. The Israeli military struck Iran early on Friday, according to three Iranian officials and two Israeli officials, in what appeared to be Israel's first military response to Iran's attack last weekend, but one whose scope, at least initially, appeared to be limited. The Iranian official said that the strike had hit a military airbase near the city of Isfahan. That's what we're just speaking about from the Jerusalem Post. In central Iran, initial reaction in both Israel and Iran was muted, which analysts said was a sign that the rivals were seeking to lower the temperature of their conflict. World leaders who for nearly a week have urged Israel and Iran to avoid sparking a broader war in the region called for both sides to de-escalate tensions on Friday, and it appears that they have responded. The Israeli military declined to comment on the strike. A senior U.S. official said Israel had notified the United States through multiple channels shortly before the attack. All the officials spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. And finally, just the background, the explosions came less than a week after Iran fired more than 300 missiles and drones at Israel, nearly all of which were shot down. They say 99% of them were shot down. And that was from two defense systems that the United States helped to build, which was the Iron Dome and David's Sling. The Iranian attack was in response to an April 1st strike on an Iranian diplomatic compound. It wasn't the embassy. It was a compound in Syria that killed seven Iranian officials, including two generals with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. That attack, says the New York Times, brought the decades-long shadow war between Israel and Iran, waged on land, at sea, in air, and in cyberspace, more clearly into the open. And with all of that going on, there is progress, and it's very important, in the House of Representatives. The House today advanced bills sending aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Indo-Pacific allies, very prominently Taiwan. The vote wasn't close. It was 361-94, with rare help from Democrats, 165 Democrats and 151 Republicans voted together to overcome a key procedural hurdle, opening up debate and teeing up final passage. This is very good news, and there's an editorial which I think says a great deal, praising Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, who, whatever else he does as Speaker of the House, this is a big deal. It just is. It's a big deal for America. It's a big deal for the Western Alliance. And it's a big deal for the Republican Party. With 151 Republicans working together with 165 Democrats, what that means is an overwhelming majority of Republicans defied some of the anti-Ukraine, pro-Putin faction within the Republican Party. Speaking of which, there is a charge that Marjorie Taylor Greene is the new Neville Chamberlain. We'll be speaking with Kevin Williamson about why he thinks that charge is unfair to Neville Chamberlain. We'll speak about that coming up on the Medved Show. And the NYPD, the New York Police Department, out in front of the courthouse where Donald Trump is on trial in the hush money case, claiming that he falsified records and basically defrauded people in regard to trying to get them to keep quiet about, specifically the former president's involvement with Stormy Daniels. She's expected to be a witness. With all of that going on, that's been upstaged by this horrific event. The NYPD said they do not have any indication of a criminal record, that the person who lit himself on fire and very deliberately lighting himself on different parts of his body after he had poured gasoline all over himself, that before that happened, he had thrown up a number of pamphlets, and the report from the Washington Post is that those pamphlets referenced former President George W. Bush, former President Vice President Al Gore, and the lawyer David Boies, who represented Al Gore in the 2000 presidential election recount. I mean, hard to believe, isn't it, that 24 years later, there's somebody who would be upset enough about the presidential recount? The individual who set himself on fire is in the hospital. He's apparently in very critical condition. And at least according to the police sources who were speaking to the press just moments ago, at the moment he is still alive. It is not clear at all where that is going. One thing that is known about him, he was in an area of the park, it's Collect Pond Park, that was cordoned off for supporters of Donald Trump. Meanwhile, we asked a question yesterday, and it is, that does give us something to look forward to at a time when there is such great polarization about the jury and the trial and what is going to happen next. Lara Trump, who is the daughter-in-law, of course, of President Donald Trump, she's married to his son, Eric. She is now the co-chair of the Republican National Committee, and she was speaking to a small group of enthusiastic Trump loyalists, and she made these comments, which have attracted a good deal of attention. This is clip 10.
Didn't know what was going on within the media, within Washington, D.C. He exposed a lot of people, so they have to do everything they can to keep him out of that White House because they know Donald Trump gets in for four more years. The jig is up for them. The gloves are off. There are no holds barred here. He is going full throttle. He's not worried about winning another election. It's 4 years of scorched earth when Donald Trump retakes the White House.
How's that for a campaign slogan? 4 years of scorched earth. right. This on the same day that there's a man on fire, yes, too soon, as Jeremy Steiner, Pride of Hillsdale College, says. How would that work as a campaign slogan? Vote for Trump, you get four more years of scorched earth. Is that really what most people want? Look, it is shocking. They did a survey that of young people, people under the age of 35, I believe it is, the percentage who believe that America's on the right track It's 9%. This is one of the real problems that Joe Biden has winning this election, especially because that election was based largely, his previous win in 2020 was based on doing well with younger voters. He's not doing well with younger voters now. And many of those younger voters actually are looking at people like fringe candidates like Cornel West and Robert Kennedy Jr., not to mention the Green Party candidate, who is always a factor. Meanwhile, who's on the jury? The jury is made up of 7 men and 5 women who live in different parts of Manhattan, including the Upper East Side, Harlem, Hell's Kitchen, and the West Village. They come from a range of personal backgrounds and employment histories. Several jurors said they had no strong opinions on Trump. I guess they're the only people in the country who have no strong opinions on Trump. A few said they do not closely follow the news. The exact racial makeup of the jury and the ages of the jurors is unclear. There are at least 3 of the jurors who are naturalized American citizens, who are people who are here from other countries, one from Lebanon, one from Spain, and one from Ireland. Juror number 1, and we don't have the names of these people because they're being kept secret for their own protection and isolation from people who might want to persuade them one way or another. That's the whole idea. Juror number 1 is a man who works in sales and previously worked as a waiter. He has some college education, married with no children. Says he gets his news from a range of outlets such as the New York Times, the Daily Mail, Fox News, and MSNBC. What does that sound like to you? It sounds to me like New York Times, MSNBC, balanced by Fox News. So who knows? Juror number 2 is a married man who works at investment banking. He has an MBA in finance. He described himself as someone who reads basically everything and said that while he doesn't hold any strong beliefs or opinions, he does follow the news and sees Trump's Truth Social posts via Twitter. He told the court that he had not read any of Trump's books, but had seen quotes from The Art of the Deal. Juror number 3 is a man who appeared to be in his late 20s or early 30s, who is originally from the West Coast. He works in corporate law and said that he gets his news from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Google. It goes on. It's 7 men, 5 women, which I think indicates that for women it would be harder in a case like this to be impartial. Coming up, Victor Davis Hanson, senior fellow at the Victor Davis Hanson joins us on the Michael Medved Show. He is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he specializes in military history and classics. He's the author of over 2 dozen books. Yes, that's productive, including the Second World Wars, and that's plural. Which is the point he makes in that excellent book, which I've enjoyed and benefited from. He's also the author of The Dying Citizen, The End of Everything, and coming up, The End of Everything, it's full colon, How Wars Descend into Annihilation. Victor, if the attack last night by Israel on targets within Iran and apparently some additional targets in Syria and Lebanon as well. Does this look like we're descending into annihilation, or as the press seems to gather, moving toward de-escalation?
Well, I think it was designed to show Iran that there's going to be a reply for attacking Israel for the first time in their homeland. They have the ability to show them that they, unlike the Iranians, they can get through the defenses and they can get very near or almost an exact location of what would be needed to take out much of their nuclear plant. And then it was further designed, as I understand it, or I assume, that the point would be to tell Iranians, it's your turn now. We took out the Republican Guard in Syria. You replied to us. We replied to you. Now what do you want to do? And I think we're at a standstill because the next round will either de-escalate and Iran will back off, or they'll be forced to do something. But the next response will be overwhelming from Israel. So we're kind of, it's kind of like you're in an old West shootout and both people are staring at each other and they both shot at their feet and now nobody knows what's next. But the decision is in Iran's court now. I think that was by intent on the part of Israelis.
Yes, and again, when you talk about trying to send Iran a message, that's a message in your commentary today in Real Clear Politics, where you ask the question, are Iran's nine lives nearing an end? One of the reports from the Jerusalem Post is that the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, successfully took out the nearest air defense battery near Isfahan, which is the center of the Iran nuclear program. That is not necessarily, is it, a signal that they're going to go after that program with some deep bunker-busting bombs that they apparently have. That's not an indication that that's the next step necessarily for Israel.
Not necessarily. I think it depends on what Iran does, because I think they're increasingly using the Turks and other third parties to tell everybody they don't want to escalate. And why is that? And that is, they understand now that they cannot really penetrate Israel's defenses, or if they attempt to, Israel might have allies that would help them. And then more importantly, they see how vulnerable they are, and world opinion isn't really on their side. And Hamas is all but destroyed, and I think Israel will eventually destroy it. And I think the Hezbollah people, the Arabs in Beirut, are saying, do I really want to have an exchange with Israel given what happened to Hamas and die for the Shia Persians in Iran? So I think they're in a quandary, and they're trying to figure out, how do we keep face domestically, and how do we reassure our surrogates that they've got to keep pressing Israel? And Israel's saying, you figure it out, and it's up to you to do what you want, but the next time we hit you, it's not going to be for demonstration purpose. It's going to take out your deterrent or your grid or your bases or something. And so it's very strange. They talk a great game, but right now they're reassuring third parties that they see this as the end.
You have written a terrific piece, which we spoke about on air in your absence, for American Greatness, about Gaza and the truths behind all the lies. Have you been surprised at all that so many Americans, with particularly these extremely energetic, is that's one word, demonstrations against Israel for Hamas. Have you been surprised to see so many of our fellow countrymen who seem to be coming down on the side of the terror organization, the degenerate bloodstained terrorist organization, Hamas?
No, I haven't. I've been just sort of watching what's happened where I work at Stanford over the last 10 years, but especially the last 3 years, and there was a kind of a perfect storm of forces that I began to notice. One is these universities are having financial challenges, so they're letting an increasingly number of foreign students. There's a lot of foreign money, not just for the Chinese, but for Middle East studies. We're into repertory admission, so at Stanford, the number of so-called white students is about 20% of the 2,000 people admitted each year. We are not requiring SAT scores, which has kind of made a crisis among the faculty, where they either have to lessen the workload of existing courses or inflate the grades or introduce new courses. And part of the fallout from all that, there's a lot more Middle Eastern students on campus. They're a lot more emboldened. There's a lot fewer Jewish students than ever before on campus. And the faculty and the administration is a lot, after George Floyd especially, are a lot more woke and emboldened. And you put all that together, and I was not surprised to see a Stanford professor tell his Jewish students to go to one side of the classroom, or to tear down posters, or they ran out, earlier they had run out a federal judge of transgendered students in the law school. So I was pretty accustomed to it. I think it's going to get worse, to tell you the truth.
And one of the points you make is one of the big lies about Gaza is the whole idea of occupied Gaza. You make the point that every American should know that Israel deoccupied Gaza, left, took out forcibly even a few thousand settlers. No occupation of Gaza since 2005. Why is it so hard for people to see that?
I don't think they really want to see it. I think after the Obamas and now with Biden, they've bought into this oppressed, oppressor, victim, victimizer binary, and they just make simplistic, they put their finger in the air and they say, where is the center of gravity on campus? Where are the students? Where are the faculty? And what pays dividend? Kind of like the Oakland Raiders or San Francisco 49ers, when they're 10-0, you want to go to the games. When they're 0-10, you don't. So a lot of these people are mindless, and they just say, well, you know, it's cool, it's neat. These are the Middle Eastern students. Wear a mask, wear a scarf. That makes you woke. The faculty like you. The administration prefers that. Let's just make that choice. And who wants to be
even better,
for Israel?
Even better, wear a keffiyeh. I'm glad you're not wearing one. Victor Davis Hanson, his pieces, both of them that we talked about, are up at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back with road closing protests, how to put an end to them, that coming up.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, a lot of action, none of it particularly encouraging in New York City, of course. The demonstrations at Columbia University are back, cleared away by the cops yesterday. Now, apparently, there are even more people who have tried to occupy that same area and to support the pro-Hamas demonstrators, who include, as one of the demonstrators arrested yesterday, the daughter of Ilhan Omar, who, the Democratic congressman from Minnesota. Her daughter is a student at Columbia who managed to be the third person to be arrested yesterday. With all of that going on, there has been progress, and the other violence in New York, trying to figure out the mystery of the suicidal individual who lit himself on fire in front of the Trump courthouse. Well, it's not called the Trump courthouse, really, but it's the one that his presence is dominating as he is under trial with the hush money charges. With all this going on, a very powerful indication of where they are in New York City with these demonstrators. We're going to be speaking next hour to Megan McArdle, columnist for The Washington Post, who has, I think, an absolutely spot-on idea for putting an end to the protests that close roads and block traffic and shut down airports and cities and what needs to be done. And this goes somewhat more realistically than the suggestion made by Senator Tom Cotton of citizens taking matters into their own hands. You really want to take matters into your own hands against some of the pro-Hamas demonstrators? Heard outside Columbia University last night, never forget the 7th of October. That will happen not one more time, not five more times, not 10, not 100, not 1,000, but 10,000 times. The 7th of October is going to be every day for you. It sounded like this. Listen, clip 12.
No, remember the 7th of October.
Never forget the 7th of October.
That will happen.
Never forget the 7th of October.
Not one more time. Not five more times. Not 10 more times. Not 100 more times. Not 1,000 more times.
Yes,
but 10,000.
You ready? The 7th of October is about to be every day. Every day.
Every day, 10,000 times. Now, 10,000 times, there are 1,200 people who were massacred on the 7th of October, including babies who were put in microwaves and babies who had their heads cut off. And the appalling level of the violence that these students are putting forward. And by the way, Columbia University has, I mentioned this yesterday, it has one of the largest Jewish student bodies of any major university. There are an estimated 5,000 Jewish students at Columbia. How do you feel if you're trying to get to class, mind your own business, and there are these lunatics who are shouting at you, 7th October will happen 10,000 more times. 7th of October is going to be every day for you. And basically they're addressing, who are they addressing? It's not just Israelis. It is the people here in the United States who the crazies loathe, including the president they call Genocide Joe. Harold Ford Jr., former Democratic congressman from Tennessee, was on Fox News on the 5. And this is a remarkably sound and important point. Clip 11.
I'm the only one in this set here who's actually voted for funding for these things. This is absurd that we find ourselves in a situation where tenured professors, I heard my friend Robert Wolf on with Martha earlier, and he said one of the things he was hoping and praying for was that these universities, I'm a graduate of a school that's been in the news here, Penn, and that these universities are looking at how you undo some of these tenured professors. Can you fire them for cause? Because this would seem to be for cause. Two, you don't hear any of these protesters, Brian, asking for the release of the hostages.
Nope. Oh,
you don't hear any. I'm with Jesse. Everyone has a right to protest, but their protest is what you started up. They are warning that they are claiming death to America. They're praising a terrorist organization. Hamas has been designated a terrorist organization. Can you imagine being on the street saying, "I love ISIS"?
Right.
That's the equivalent of what these people do. Now, some may say they don't know what they're doing. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, they do know what they're doing. And that's why it is such good news and such positive news and such a big credit for Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, that they advanced the bills that they're going to vote on, I think, by tomorrow night, sending aid to Ukraine, to Israel, and to Taiwan. And again, the vote, thanks to the 151 Republicans, that's 151 Republicans out of slightly more than 200. What is it? It's 218 Republicans who are in the House. 151 of them voted for this bill. So there is much less Republican objection. It's just a handful of people. But that handful made it necessary for Republicans and Democrats to come together. And House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat from New York, says that yesterday the Democrats decided to vote in favor of advancing GOP foreign aid bills out of the Rules Committee. Here's why he described his, how he described his reasoning on that issue. Clip 7.
I speak with Mike Johnson frequently. We have a open, honest, and communicative relationship. I did not talk to him this morning. We made a decision last evening that we would do what is necessary to provide the votes on the Rules Committee to ensure that the legislation could be heard on the House floor today. Once we made that decision, it was clear that we would do what was necessary to make sure that the national security legislation was considered by the entire House of Representatives.
Okay, and with this triumph, Marjorie Taylor Greene, of course, is not at all happy. And because he is working together with almost a united force of the Democratic Party, well, this is Mike Johnson has to go. This is how Marjorie Taylor Greene explains that logic on Real America's Voice Network. Listen.
Johnson has made a deal with Democrats. This is what everyone needs to understand. I can't make this any more clear. A Republican Speaker of the House cannot get Democrat votes without making a deal with the Democrats. And for him to get the Democrats on the Rules Committee to vote for the Republican rule last night, we all need to be asking the most concerning question. What has Mike Johnson made a deal to do? What has he promised he will give them in the future? And this is why we have to remove Mike Johnson from the speakership, because he has made a deal. And then it passed again today with Democrat votes on the House floor. And then tomorrow, we will watch this bill package come to the floor that gives another $61 billion to Ukraine.
Okay, and she says with Democrat votes, and three-quarters of the Republicans. There are 151 Republicans who voted against Marjorie Taylor Greene. Basically, there was a an attempt to put forward a an amendment to this bill they're considering that they would rename the Capitol office for Marjorie Taylor Greene the Neville Chamberlain Room. Now, that has led Kevin Williamson to write a fairly fascinating column defending Neville Chamberlain. We will get to that. We'll be talking with Megan McArdle about what you have to do to stop demonstrators, Hamas, pro-Hamas demonstrators, from blocking highways. That and more coming up in this greatest nation on God's green earth.